From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, August the 17th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you today. We're going to be speaking in the first hour with Dan Richardson. He's a frequent guest on the Dave Graham Show. Normally provides purely legal analysis and so on. He's the former president of the Vermont Bar Association. He's taught at Vermont Law School. He is a very versatile attorney based in Montpelier. But in this case, he's also a Montpelier city councilor. And in that role last week, he wrote a policy and got it passed by the council dealing with the question of when the city approves or does not approve the writing of various slogans and so on in the streets. Of course, Montpelier famously earlier this summer allowed the allowed Black Lives Matter to be written in very large block letters on State Street right in front of the State House. And that later on was responded to in one instance by a person who wanted to paint the words Liberty and Justice for All on State Street. So far, the city has rejected that request, and a little bit of controversy surrounding that, of course, and the city now has decided to come up with a policy on that'll sort of be what it how it handles these requests going into the future. We're going to be talking with Dan Richardson about that in just a moment. After I tell you about the very special second hour we've got coming up on the Dave Graham Show this morning, I'm going to invite in three of my extended family members. We're celebrating extra hard this month the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, because my dad's aunt, Betty Graham, later Betty Graham Swing, was one of the leading suffragists back in the day and got arrested several times, and she is quite well known in those circles of folks who study that period of our history. She also was written up recently in the New York Times. There was a couple of her descendants were interviewed in the story, in which the Times talked about current day feminists who are sort of carrying on the legacy of those suffragists and still pushing for women's equality. And two of the people interviewed were Pam Swing and Anna Plotkin Swing. They happen to be cousins of mine, we're going to be having them on, as well as a niece of mine, Danielle Graham, who also in her own right has been very active on the national scene in pushing for, in one instance, getting more women elected to Congress. We'll be talking with Danielle about that. So it's going to be, an interesting second hour of the program this morning, and I'm really excited to involve a few family members in this the discussion of this 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. But let's get right into it with Dan Richardson. First, I believe he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Dan. Good having you on the program.
Morning, Dave, and thanks for having me, and happy Bennington Battle Day as well.
That's right. Well, I looked it up. I was going to talk about that right in the intro here, but then I discovered that was actually yesterday, according to what I read. I've always been confused about that. I think sometimes I see it as quoted as the 17th, sometimes the 16th. So it sounds like you are of the view that it's the 17th. I don't know. Maybe it was an overnight battle or something.
But I am, but I'm also of the tradition that if it's on Sunday, we should probably recognize it on Monday when we actually.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true too. So happy Bennington Battle Day. That was a battle that was clearly won by Vermont, because from what I understand, it was fought mainly by men from New Hampshire on New York soil, but Vermont gets the holiday. Is that how it works?
That's right.
Yeah, so Vermont was a clear winner in that one. Anyway, it's a good time to maybe have an extra day off and a cookout or something in the middle of the summer here. So, well, let's talk about this interesting debate over free speech and public displays of various opinions, and how much the degree to which government needs to tolerate that and or avoid looking like it's endorsing some idea. It's kind of a real conundrum and a ball of confusion in some respects, but you tried to sort it all out last week. I think you did a pretty good job of it in this new policy you authored for the city of Montpelier. Tell us what it says.
Sure. Well, I can start with the policy. The policy itself is attempting to put a degree of clarity on any type of process that the council goes through going forward. You know, as I said in my remarks at the city council, this was an issue that I don't think was on many people's radar 6 months ago, but has become much more hotly debated in the past 60 days. And so, you know, trying to give both the council a set of guidelines to help their decision-making process, as well as the public, I think is really important. One of the issues that I really wanted to tackle in this policy was, frankly, a technical one, which is, you know, when the original Black Lives Matter application came forward, I think there was enthusiasm for it, but there wasn't necessarily a thinking through some of the technical details. And I think those are most important when we talk about this particular type of project, because we are talking about roadways, and our first priority in any type of situation dealing with roadways is to make sure that public safety is not unreasonably affected. And so, you know, having a policy just on the technical standards, such as, you know, putting grit into the paint, which is, you know, something that was done with Black Lives Matter painting, but, you know, should just become the standard and the expectation that we follow, so that, you know, we don't end up in a situation where we're not looking at that, or, you know, glossing over those kind of easily ignored in the heat of the moment technical issues, or, you know, making sure that the Department of Public Works, which is, and the VTrans, when they have the jurisdiction, that their voices are, you know, the first level of review to make sure, first of all, is this safe? Are we putting in, and as an example of this, for years and years, people have tried to propose paintings for the intersection of State and Main, and those have largely have uniformly been rejected. My understanding is in large part because of the safety issues involved, and that the DPW and VTrans have not been comfortable with a large painting in the center. And so I think by creating a policy that emphasizes that, you do two things. One is you make sure that that is the first level of review. And secondly, I think it helps make those technical components, the people that enforce those, more comfortable, because they know they're not backfilling something that's already been approved or is already in the works, but they're getting the first crack and making sure that the public safety issue. So that was one thing. And the second thing was just to make clear, you know, on, you know, when we as a city adopt these type of paintings, that we make sure we give both ourselves, you know, what are we looking for? And I think some of the councilors were struggling with, you know, how do we review these type of projects if they're proposed, and what is our role, as well as to the public, to say, so it doesn't seem like, well, we're picking one over the other. Although I will emphasize, and I can talk about this later when we talk about government speech, we are picking one project, and we are, you know, making it speech from the city, and there is a decision-making process in there. But, you know, when you adopt these sort of guidelines and standards, I think it helps everyone to say, oh, okay, that's why, you know, that's how the city is approaching this and reviewing it. And, you know, someone who is thinking, you know, has an important issue that thinks the city should be making a statement about X, you know, hamburgers over tacos. You know, that if they want that and they want the city to adopt it, then they have at least this guideline and standards to look at to say, you know, that's what the city has articulated as sort of their thinking process, as it were. Mm-hmm. And it's different. And the reason I emphasize this is that, you know, when you go for a zoning application, you have a set of standards that are approved by the state and that are modified and adopted by each individual municipality. And that's a process with due process rights. And that's something where an applicant can have things like vested rights. And there's a clear application process because we're dealing with private rights. And in this situation, we're not dealing with private rights. We're dealing with a city-controlled street. And so it's not necessarily, you know, this is the these are the ordinance or these are the guideline standards. But this is very much just trying to make something that, you know, helps foster, I think, positive discussions, positive requests when people, you know, they understand that this isn't, you know, if Nike, for example, wants to, you know, paint a swoosh onto one of our streets, they can look at this and go, oh, that's a non-starter because there's no commercial speech allowed and no logo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it helps avoid that.
Let me point out, I think, for folks who I mean, I just think the general public ought to know that a key feature of this, that from what I read, I just read the story the other day in the Times Argus, and the final decision is made by the council, and I frankly applaud the accountability here because, you know, you're going to vote in open council, I would gather, on yes or no on a certain slogan being painted on a certain street, let's say. And then members of the public who agree with that can re-elect you to the council. And if they don't agree with it, they can not re-elect you to the council next time, you know, next town meeting
next
day. Yeah.
Sure.
And so I just think that there's a certain simplicity and kind of clarity to that ought to appeal to the public in general. I mean, so I just want, I think that's important to point out.
No, I agree with you, Dave, very much so. And that was intended purposely. And if you read, you know, the case law on this, which is the Pleasant Grove City versus Sumnum, that talks about government speech, you know, that's what Justice Alito says is the accountability of government speech, which is, you know, it's not a First Amendment issue, but it is an accountability issue. If a city government wants to adopt some type of monument or you know, permanent, semi-permanent painting like this, that the voters are ultimately the ones that form the check and balance on this. You know, the other check and balance that can come in here is that if the legislature, you know, felt this was something that cities were mangling or not getting right, you know, they could change the laws because municipalities, at the end of the day, are creatures of the legislature. And certainly if there was a ban, you know, if somebody introduced in the legislature a statewide ban on any public, you know, any painting on public streets, then, you know, this would all be moot. But, you know, to the extent that you know, I don't think that's likely. But I also, you know, it is another check that's listed by Justice Alito in his decision. And that's the analysis. And this might be a good segue to, you know, some of the analysis that we did or I did. And I should be clear that I'm speaking only for myself, not for the city council or for the city writ large. And so this is really my own personal interpretations on a lot of this, but you know, when we look at the first, I think some of the confusion around this issue has been a confusion, with the analysis and where we begin, and people have often jumped to the First Amendment and some of the case law that surrounds how a First Amendment issue is analyzed, and that's not the right analysis, or at least it jumps the gun. We have to start with what kind of speech this is, and there's a difference. The First Amendment is intended to protect private speech from government action. Mm-hmm. But if the government itself is speaking, it's not a First Amendment issue. And so a lot of the analysis that people have gone through, it doesn't apply if the speaker itself is not a private speaker. And so if you look at, for example, the Pleasant Grove City versus Sumnum, which dealt with a monument, a Ten Commandments monument, then in a park that the Fraternal Order of Eagles had created, donated, and maintained for the city, you know, the court said, well, look, this is not a private speaker because it didn't say Fraternal Order of the Eagles. It had been adopted by the city, and it was effectively the city promoting this monument. And as a result, you know, it was not a public forum. It was not a private speaker. It was government speech. It was the government of the city saying, we as a community believe this Ten Commandments monument is important. Just as city council in Montpelier said, you know, when approached about the Black Lives Matter, said this as a statement was an important statement to make, and supported the statement. And we can talk about the sort of room for interpretation of said statement and its meaning. But again, Pleasant Grove City versus Sumnum also talks about that as well. And it does talk about the idea that, you know, multiple interpretations of monuments and art pieces and are common. That's what they, you know, people are going to react differently to them. But when the city adopts it, and they may adopt it with the understanding that people are going to have multiple reactions to it, but it's the city putting that out there and the city making that speech as opposed to an individual or private entity that is speaking.
The state actually has a policy talking about things which are profane or grotesque being excluded from any protection when painted onto public property in Vermont. And is that something that the city will do too?
You know, I don't know if we're going to adopt that policy or simply let that VTrans policy govern. You know, we will continue to control, and this is by statute, you know, 19 PSA section 303 talks about that local municipalities have control and general governance over the streets, and that is a hallmark of government speech, is that they are you know, they are forums or areas where they are privately held and they're controlled, and they're not held out to the public. And so I fully expect that the city will continue to, you know, police its streets and how its streets are used. In part, again, you know, this is a public safety issue. Yep. You know, when we, you know, it's all well and good to paint something on the street, but our first and foremost mission should be to make sure that our streets remain safe and open for people to travel upon, and that somebody coming into an intersection, for example, is not confused how to turn or how to follow the traffic markers there.
Yeah, yeah. Let's bring in our caller, Rama from Williamstown's on the line. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. This is in reference to the second proposed street painting. I guess everybody calls it a mural. I don't know. Is it really a mural? But that's a side issue. But the second set of statements that was wanted to be painted on the streets was being primarily headlined by a declared candidate for office. And I know you haven't gotten through all of your policy description as far as what's in it, but I'm just wondering if that comes into play, and I'm going to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Good question, Rama. If somebody wanted to paint MAGA on Main Street in Montpelier, Make America Great Again, which is, of course, easily recognized slogan of the Trump campaign of 2016, would that be allowed?
Well, I mean, again, it would have to go through the analysis. You know, political speech is a little bit different. And if our community, you know, the way in which this policy is written and intended, at least the way I intend to follow the policy is to look at each application, you know, that comes, a request, I should say, that comes through, you know, as does it reflect our community and a value and the various standards and guidelines through that. And so, you know, I think for a statement like MAGA, I don't think it reflects the general consensus of Montpelier as a community. And I think we do have to be careful about statements like that are being used primarily by a political group. But MAGA is a good example in that it started out as a Trump slogan. And you know, if Joe Biden has a slogan you know, it's the same sort of analysis, but MAGA has seemingly gained a bit more cachet. It's gone beyond its campaign roots, and it's come to mean more for some people, positive, for some people very negative. And that's a great example of something where, you know, if we did have a community that felt very strongly that this was a value and that this was something that needed to be promoted and needed to be stated, then, you know, it might be something where, you know, the legislature, which is the city council, supported by the voters, felt like this is a statement that, that needed to be made public as a statement of the community. Yeah. But again, it's also one of those statements that I think, you know, has certain baggage in that it is a bit of a divisive statement, at least as it's come to be. And that's an important part, I should say. You know, in my analysis, you know, when statements become so burdened with negativity, you know, that a city in the policy, it says very clearly, can remove any of these paintings, and whether we call them murals or paintings or installations, it doesn't matter. But it would also, you know, the city maintains that control over it.
Yeah. And again, it's a final decision of the council, and then the voters get to decide whether they agree. I think it's a good example of kind of, you know, democracy in action. So, works. Sure. It works for me, and I get what you're saying about, you know, a city council might have it's supposed to have its finger on the sentiment of the city or the pulse of the city or whatever. So there you go. Hey, we need to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And we'll continue our conversation with Montpelier City Councilor Dan Richardson on the other side. Stay with us, folks, and don't forget to call in and let us know what you think. We'll be back.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
My guest is Montpelier City Councilor Dan Richardson, and we are talking about a policy adopted by the council just last week to govern the display of signs and slogans and et cetera, murals, maybe some people call them, in our streets. The Black Lives Matter, huge block letters saying that in front of the State House and State Street. The leading example right now, I'd say, and certainly in the capital city. And Dan Richardson, the other offer for the Liberty and Justice for All, I'm trying to picture where that was going to go. Was that going to be to the east or the west of the Black Lives Matter sign?
It was both, actually. It was a proposal to bracket the Black Lives Matter, to put an American flag to the left of the Black Lives Matter, to the east, and then to the west, to put the words "Liberty and Justice for All."
I see. Okay, and that was rejected by the council. Do you have any recollection for, you know, what were some of the reasons councilors cited for deciding that wasn't the design of choice?
Sure. I mean, there were a number of, you know, and councilors spoke individually about this. Certainly one of the issues was painting an American flag on the street. And that's something that the policy makes clear, because we had actually adopted that night the U.S. flag code that says painting an American flag on the street is not it goes against the flag code. It's disrespectful. The flag is meant to be held aloft. Putting it on a street where people drive over it is inconsistent with that. And so that
don't tread on me, right?
That night. Exactly. Well, I mean, flags are for a particular purpose, which are to be held aloft. And yep. the flag code says, you know, even if it's not a physical cotton or polyester flag, an image of the flag is the equivalent of the flag. And putting it there, you know, goes against the code. So, you know, I believe the mayor actually was the one who states that. But it's a sentiment I certainly share as well. And I was one of the movers of the flag code as the flag policy as well, in part so that, you know, we could adopt some of these standards, which I think are important. You know, if we get into these debates about some of these statements, you know, I think at first, you know, we should have some of these policies in place that, is sort of the ground rules. And certainly when we talk about flying the flag, there are protocols and rules that are important to follow first as a sign of respect, regardless of what flag we may be talking about. And then the second thing, I think there was a feeling that this was done in reaction to and intended to modify the Black Lives Matter mural that had been painted. And there was certainly a resistance from the council to modify what we had already installed. And then another factor, I believe, was the difference between the Black Lives Matter mural that was really came from the community itself. It came from residents of Montpelier. It came from a city councilor who acted as a sponsor for it, as opposed to the second proposal that was largely people from outside of the community that felt very strongly about it and passionate about it, but, you know, were not the Montpelier residents. And I understand that, you know, this is State Street that goes in front of the Capitol, and so it carries a little bit more weight. You know, a few weeks later, Burlington has painted Black Lives Matter on Main Street, and I don't know if they've gotten an application from people. And so it may be some of that symbolic weight, but at the same time, it is a city street. And it is a city decision at the end of the day. You know, if this, again, this is one of those things where, as a creature of the legislature, if this, you know, one solution down the road could be if it felt that Montpelier was not honoring its obligations to maintain streets in front of the Capitol or was abusing its rights to do so, or responsibilities to do so, you know, the legislature could certainly take that over. You know, for example, the Capitol complex, the Capitol itself is exempt from most of Montpelier zoning by statutory decree. So, you know, that could easily be another part of it if it was felt that, you know, Montpelier was not maintaining or upholding its responsibilities.
Right. One of the provisions, I believe, in the policy that I saw was that the a proposal for a new sign in the street would have to be proposed by a member or sponsored by a member, actually, of the city council. So the first step, it seems, to get this, if you have an idea for such a slogan on the pavement, would be to get a city councilor on board who's willing to bring it in to the full council and say, hey, I've got this idea here. Is that how it goes?
Right. It is, and it's intended. You know, if you're going to have the city council approve it, it would seem logical that the first step would be to see if one of the seven members is willing to sponsor it, agree to say it's a good idea.
Yes,
and this is also. Oh, sorry. This is also the idea that, you know, this is not an application process. These are requests that are being made for the city to make these statements. And we felt, at least I felt in drafting it, that it was an important sort of check on that process that, you know, rather than just sort of throwing spaghetti at the wall during business meetings, that, you know, there was some attempt to reach out to the council. There was some attempt to work with the city and see, you know, test the waters, you know. You know, I'll just give as a for example, you know, one of the reasons we were just talking about for the second application, not being well received by the city council was its location. Now, if it was located in a different place, if it was on Taylor Street, if it was on another city street, it would have a different impact. And, you know, that's something that I think oftentimes comes out of those informal conversations where, you know, a requester who's looking to make that statement and can engage with a city councilor who can say, you know, these are concerns that I know my fellow councilors are going to have. Is there any way to modify this? You know, because it might be more palatable. I think that's important as well.
Sure. We have another listener calling in. I believe it's Geraldine from East Calais. Good morning, Geraldine.
Good morning. I've been listening to your program ever since you started. You know, I know what I feel should be done. Instead of getting into all of this crap about Black Lives Matter, yes, they do. But, you know, that could cause problems here, I guess. Anyway, what I think that should we do, all lives matter. All lives matter. It doesn't matter what color your skin is or anything else. It's individuals that all lives matter. That's what I would like to see put up in a lot of these bigger cities and stuff, because there's a lot of people that are being killed now that they're not color, of color. And I'm sick and tired of this going on. And I think we should protect all of our people that live here in the United States. And
all right,
that's
Geraldine.
All I've got to say.
Well, thank you for the call. Dan Richardson, there was an incident earlier this summer where trying to remember which town it was, somewhere down in southern Vermont, where there were the words BLM, meaning Black Lives Matter, BLM is racist, were painted on a road, on a public roadway. I think this one being a state highway, and a V-Trans crew did come along and erase or paint over, or I'm not exactly sure how they removed that slogan. And there are some who argue that if you're going to allow the display of a slogan like Black Lives Matter, well, you know, BLM is racist is just another point of view on the political spectrum and should have equal First Amendment rights to be expressed or whatever. We've touched on this a little bit, but I wanted you to go ahead and address that argument more explicitly.
Sure. I mean, this goes back to the government speech argument, which is that the governments can speak and they don't have to. You know, and this was the whole point of the Pleasant Grove City case, in that, you know, you had a competing religions monument that wanted to be installed in the park next to the Ten Commandments, and the city said no. And they sued, of course, saying, you know, you got to let everyone in. You let one in, you let everyone in. And the Supreme Court, in their decision, and it's a unanimous decision. It's written by Justice Samuel Alito. But it's a unanimous decision, so it's not a 5-4 controversial decision. It's a pretty solid and well-written decision that says, no, when government speaks, it may choose what it says. And I certainly, you know, I don't, and this goes back to the other point about interpretation, which is I understand that some people will read BLM or Black Lives Matter, and they will take a very narrow interpretation or a very uncharitable interpretation to it. And that's certainly fair. That's a private opinion. And if they wanted to have a rally or if they wanted to stand on a street corner and protest and say what the last caller said, that's certainly their right to do so. And that's a First Amendment right. But when if a government chooses to make a statement such as Black Lives Matter on the street, it's a government speech, and the government doesn't have to give equal time to every single possible point of view in conjunction with that. It is very much something where the government itself is speaking, and it can control that. Again, this goes back to the control of the streets and what we talked about before, which is, you know, the check and balance here is political accountability. You know, we as city council... voted for this, and if people disagree with it in the city of Montpelier, you know, we're all up for election within the next year or two.
The was it Grove City or what was the name of the place in that Aledo decision?
Pleasant Grove City.
Pleasant, okay. Pleasant Grove City.
Grove City, Pennsylvania, that I always mess that up with as well.
Okay. So this is Pleasant Grove City. I'm not sure where. But anyway, rather immaterial for this discussion. Samuel Alito actually wrote pretty extensively on the questions of kind of the manner in which the speech is made. In other words, are you shouting it at a rally? Are you chanting it as part of a group of marchers? Are you are you holding up a sign saying this? Eventually, he said all of these demonstrators will tire and go home, and yet the slogan painted on the street has some greater degree of permanence to it, and that's a key difference, isn't it?
It is. It is a key difference, and it's also a key difference in that when somebody is shouting a slogan or somebody is shouting a statement in a rally, it's hard to mistake who is saying what. But when you start to do things like paint on a street, install a monument, now it's very unclear who is speaking. You know, and it is associated with the city for better or for worse. You know, the city of Montpelier and every city that's painted Black Lives Matter is associated with that. They own it. And that's frankly, you know, a lot of the conservative commentators that have talked about this have said, you know, this is fine, but the people who, you know, either say it or paint it, the cities that paint it, have an ownership stake in it as a result.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they have to live with the consequences of it. You know, and certainly that's something that should give pause to every city government that is considering these kind of things and thinking it through. And again, that's part of the reason I developed this policy, is so that we would have that in place, so that we would think these things through, and that we would, you know, give reasoned and rationed thought to why we would adopt certain requests or ideas, either self-generated or proposed by members of the community, as opposed to others, and to be thoughtful about it, to make sure that we were doing things that were positive for the community.
Yeah, it's by the way, on that question of All Lives Matter versus Black Lives Matter or whatever, I've said elsewhere that you know, I spent a long career in journalism, and I never wrote a headline that said "Dawn expected tomorrow," because that would not be considered news. And the distinction here is that the idea that all lives matter, I think everyone understands that. That's not really news either. And the trouble is that to some people, the idea that Black Lives Matter is news. That's why that is being made a headline. Do you think the city council would do if it got competing proposals for a Go Sox versus Go Yanks slogan painted on Main Street in Montpelier?
I guess it would depend on the season. As someone said to me this weekend, the Sox are not having a good season this year. But no, in all seriousness, I don't know if that would be something that would rise to the level of needed statement for the community, and we might we might reject both.
Let that one go. Okay. Well, let's see here. I think we do have another caller on the line, but I'm. We do have another caller on the line. Is that right, Dana? All right. Caller, please identify yourself. I think we lost Hello. Track of your name.
Hello?
Yes. Good morning. Who's calling, please?
Art from Randolph.
Art from Randolph. There we go. Sorry about that, Art. Yeah. That one slipped away from me. What's on your mind?
Well, everybody can realize all lives matter, which is fine, but what really bothers me is I've never seen such a peak in racism, because personally, I do also believe anybody that has anything to do with Black Lives Matter are very racist and are trying to cause racism in this country. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Ruth, what's on your mind? It's Ruth from Sheldon. What's on your mind this morning?
Yes, well, that's me that your guest keeps saying that this is a Montpelier matter, but they chose to put the Black Lives Matter sign right in front of the State House. So I think it makes it a state matter. And I agree that maybe the American flag shouldn't have been painted on the street because we should accept flag protocol, but that goes the same for putting Black Lives Matter on, at the schools on the same flagpole as the American flag because that is totally against protocol. The only flag that should be up with the American flag is the state flag. So I think you're being hypocritical, and I think basically overall you are wrong. You can have a policy if you want, but your policy is wrong. I don't think it's up to you to decide. I just think it's wrong.
Okay, thanks for the call, Ruth. Dan Richardson, it is an interesting question where you have a street that is really pretty central to the state complex, and a lot of people who come in to Montpelier on state business are going to be on State Street. Funny thing, it has that name. Right in front of the state house. What about this argument that maybe the state should have the decision-making authority over what is painted on the street in front of the state house?
I mean, that's the state's prerogative if it wished to do so, and it wished to take over the control and maintenance of the street. As I said before, I mean, that's one of the checks and balances on this. If the state felt that the city was not upholding its responsibilities with the street or abusing them, the state can step in at any moment. I do want to make one sort of comment to the last caller, which is that, you know, the flag protocol does allow other flags to be flown as long as the United States flag is, of course, the highest flag flown. And, there are even by state law, you know, the POW MIA flag is allowed to be flown as well. And those can be flown on the same flagpole as long as the American flag is the highest. So, you know, in other hats that I wear, I am affiliated with various organizations like the Boy Scouts that, take these things seriously. And I try to be thoughtful. And I think the last caller's point is not the policy itself. It's the decisions that the council has made. And that's fair. You know, people can disagree about these things. And again, you know, if it was something where the state felt we were not following our, you know, the best interests of the community and wanted to take control and wanted to make State Street different, they certainly can. And if the people in the community of Montpelier felt that this was not appropriate, you know, they have their vote. And they have their right to send that message as well. And those are the checks and balances. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there are decisions that cities make that cause people to disagree. And, you know, I certainly don't take that away from the caller.
Did I read correctly about the policy that it has there's a time limit on these displays? In other words, you can paint something in the street, the approval of the city council, it is going to stay there for a year and then needs to be removed. Is that it, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, no. What we did was we put in a sort of default provision of a year, just basically so that there was some limit to this. But it's one in which the council has discretion to extend. And in part, it's a function of the fact that, you know, our streets in our city do change because we scrape them every day in the winter. And whatever's painted on them goes away as we see the crosswalks, the median lines, the parking spaces.
For
exactly.
Sure. Will there need to be another decision, I would gather, then next spring about extending the life of the Black Lives Matter sign on State Street?
Yes. Okay. I think we would have to do that. And at least under the policy, you know, we didn't make a time limit when we agreed to install it back in June. But I would see that as something we would want to revisit next June.
All right. Well, Dan Richardson, speaking of time limits, we're about out of time on this segment of the Dave Graff Show. Really appreciate you joining me this morning to talk about all this. It's been quite a discussion in Montpelier and in Vermont as elsewhere. So thanks very much, Dan.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
Going to head into some top-of-the-hour news from CBS, and then stay tuned for a very special second hour of the Dave Graff Show. We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. Into our second hour of the Dave Graham Show. We normally like to line up one of our CBS News correspondents at this time of the show. We're unable to do that today. I suspect they're all busy out there covering different national stories right now. Good news is that we get to open the phone lines for the next 10 or 15 minutes here, and folks want to weigh in on that discussion we were having in the first 15 minutes, the first hour of the program this morning. We are happy to hear more of your thoughts on these questions of public displays of various slogans, etc. The Black Lives Matter slogan famously painted in several places around Vermont, including Main Street in Burlington now. Of course, a couple months ago on State Street in front of the State House in Montpelier. And we have a request that went into the City Council in Montpelier to bracket that Black Lives Matter slogan with an American flag and then the words Liberty and Justice for All on the other side. That request was rejected, one reason being that you're not supposed to paint a flag on the ground. Then you end up walking on it, and that's not very respectful to a flag which is supposed to, according to the rules, be held aloft. According to Dan Richardson, an attorney in Montpelier, also city councilor and author of the city's new policy on how it will decide whether a specific request for a slogan in the street is going to be allowed to be put there. And interesting, several facets of the policy the city council adopted last week, including a year-long time limit. So after a year, the city council apparently will need to make another decision about whether Montpelier should continue to have displayed in that very prominent location in front of the Vermont State House on State Street the words Black Lives Matter, or whether that should be done away with at the end of its first year in place. And I suspect that any move to do away with it would generate a lot of controversy. There may be some discussion around a decision to extend it as well. So stay tuned here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, because I bet you by next spring we'll be talking about all of this again in some fashion or another. Happy to take your thoughts about it, though, if you call in to 244-1777. That's a local number in Waterbury. And then the toll-free number, of course, 1-877-291-8255. We have about 10 minutes to go until our next break, and then we're going to be having a discussion about women's suffrage. 100 years ago this month, the women got the right to vote in the United States of America, and I'm really looking forward to a conversation we've lined up about that starting at around 10:15. All right, we got Paul from Moncton on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Hey, a very serious but thoughtful kind of topic for
practice these days. And I guess my question is this. What happens if in between now and the end of the year, I come in and I say I would like to put something on the street referencing pro-life movements and the, you know, abortions and the murdering, in my estimation, of, you know, thousands of babies, especially the fact that quite a few of them are actually minority children, unborn children. Would that, if they decide to extend the Black Lives Movement banner or whatever it is for another year, does that mean they're judging me differently than they did Black Lives? Does that mean when my time comes, I get to have 2 years? I, you know, and that's, I mean, anybody who puts up something that is, you know, not hate generating and not, you know, with bad language or anything like that, comes in and wants to do that. I just see their biggest problem facing a lawsuit is not being equitable in terms of how much time they allow, you know, anybody who wants to put something on that street.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things Dan Richardson said repeatedly in that first hour there was that the court rulings have indicated that this kind of an expression turns into government speech when it's allowed to stand for a period of time on the street and or in a park, if in the case of a statue or a monument or something like that. It turns into government speech by just by virtue of being allowed to stand. And if it's allowed to stand, that implies that the government endorses the sentiment. And it's not really about the free speech rights of individuals. Those can freely be expressed by anybody, say, marching in a parade down the street on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade to say, to make a pro-life argument if they wish. That happens every year in Montpelier. Nobody really seems to worry about that too much. But if you were to write a pro-life slogan in the street and on this public property, that now implies that the city government is taking that position. And the city government, as a government speaker, has the right to take that position or not take that position, and they vote on that. That's what Dan was saying. They vote on that, and then they're held accountable on the next election day. The city council makes a decision about, is this a slogan we want to express? And the if it's yes, all the people in the city who favored a yes vote will reelect those councilors. If it's a no, and all the people who favored a yes vote will vote against reelecting those councilors. That's the way the system appears to be set up as we move into the future now. And you know, as I was saying to Dan, I think it's a pretty straight up piece of accountability there. That's how democracy is supposed to work.
In some respects, I understand what you're saying. I would disagree to some extent, because what I've been told over and over again is Black Lives Matter is not a political movement. But what you're telling me now, by virtue of the fact that the city of Montpelier is saying that this is, you know, political speech, it is a political movement.
Yeah, I don't agree with that distinction either, because I mean, basically, I think it applies in to the Black Lives Matter. It also applies. You know, I sort of was joking with Dan about a slogan that said "Go Sox" or "Go Yanks," but clearly not a political thing. It's a sports thing, right? And so if they painted if they allowed the painting of "Go Sox" on Main Street in Montpelier, all the Yankees fans could then vote against the councilors who approved that, and vice versa.
I understand. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, no, I can see where they go. But I think they opened up a bit of a Pandora's box, and I would still, I'm doing a little research on it. I'll find out whether or not I can find something that would be not considered political speech that I would have questions about whether they would allow me to put down there or not. And let me do a little work on this and see if I can come up with a few that might challenge Dan's interpretation. Okay? Thanks, Dave.
Good. Thanks for the call, Paul. Going to Island Pond now. Is it I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Susan.
Susan from Island Pond. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I wanted to reiterate with what the woman said earlier, that sign should say all lives matter, and the selectmen and any city person who puts that out there and allows it to say Black Lives Matter should resign immediately.
Well, I don't think they're going to do that, but you if you move to Montpelier, you could probably get registered to vote in time to vote in the next municipal election, and then you can vote the bums out. You know, that's how it works. And
Because of their stance, I wouldn't think of moving to that area just because of some of their political negativity.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much your statement. I appreciate the call. Thank you for checking in, Susan. Let's see who else we get. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. And folks, they're more than welcome to check in with us for the next few minutes anyway. And then we're going to start another segment and set of interviews at around 10:15 here on the Dave Graham Show. All about the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States of America. I've been reading up a little bit on this, on the suffrage movement, and the thing it keeps striking me is that it's just kind of shocking that for the first 150 years of our nation's existence, we did not have, women didn't have the right to vote, and that sort of strikes me as, what, huh? Why? Is it Dan from Newfane we have?
Yes. Hello?
Good morning, Dan.
Hi. You know, just in response to the folks that get so mad about these flags and signs saying Black Lives Matter, my question is, do they really believe that we have given black lives equal value up till now? I mean, there's never been any question in this country that white lives matter, you know. Never. From the day the white man set on shore, his life mattered. And then a little bit later on, like a few hundred years, his women partners started to matter a little bit. You know, and not until yet had black lives really mattered. And I think the stats bear that out. You know, the numbers of blacks killed by cops, the number of blacks incarcerated, the number of blacks stopped. You know, we stop way more black motorists in Vermont than white motorists, and yet the percentage of those black motorists that have contraband or, you know, should have been stopped is much lower than the rate on the white drivers. So black lives have not mattered in this country. And so this is a statement saying we need to equalize a playing field. And so for white people to somehow take offense at this, I find that, it blows my mind, and I just can't find that to be a legitimate response.
Well, I hear where you're coming from, Dan. I do think that the it's a nice sentiment to say all lives matter. I don't really object all that unless it's being expressed as some way to diminish or negate the statement that Black Lives Matter, and the sort of newness and freshness of that statement that's only come out really in the past few years. And so if you're trying to diminish that statement, Black Lives Matter, by saying, hey, yeah, but all lives matter, then I think you really have to look at the motivation of the person using the slogan. But because obviously all lives include, as sort of a logical subset, include black lives. So when you say all lives matter, you could make an argument that, yeah, I'm including black lives because black lives obviously are included in all lives. But
I think
here's the way it breaks down for me. I mentioned this a while ago, but I think it bears repeating, which is that I spent a long time in the news business and sometimes writing headlines as part of my work. And I never wrote a headline that said Dawn expected tomorrow, because that really wasn't news.
Right.
And the thing here is that if you say all lives matter, well, that's pretty obvious. Everybody understands that. That's not really news either. The news, unfortunately, to some people, is that black lives matter, and in particular. And so that's why that is getting a big mention today, is because there's a concern that not everyone shares that understanding that black lives are among all of the lives that matter.
Yeah, I agree. And if all lives matter was the slogan that was chosen to really hammer home that black lives and white lives matter, that would be one thing. But unfortunately, all lives matter, which I agree, it's a wonderful settlement. You know, we should all agree with that, and I think we do. But right now, it's almost code for saying we don't we're not really down with the idea that Black Lives Matter. So unfortunately, we, because of the context and the societal sort of pressure right now, we have to take a what should be a perfectly benign and wonderful statement that all lives matter and contextualize it and say, well, yes, that's true technically, but in this particular time and space, that is being used as a code to try to denigrate the idea that Black lives have not mattered and are, it's high past time that they do matter.
All right, Dan, well, thank you for the call. I appreciate you checking in with us.
Taste of that Sly and the Family Stone tune would be a fitting intro to the next segment of our program today. This month marks the 100th anniversary of the effective date of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, saying that women would have the right to vote. August 26th will mark the exact date. It's an especially exciting moment for members of my extended family. My father's aunt, Betty Graham, later known by her married name, Betty Graham Swing, was one of the leading and most militant activists in the fight to pass women's suffrage. She went to jail multiple times, participated in hunger strikes, including one notorious action in which women were force-fed at the Occoquan Workhouse in Virginia after protesting outside the White House. Today, descendants of the suffragists continue to carry on their work toward equality for women in government, business, and other walks of life. Three of Betty Graham's descendants, who I'm proud to say are kinfolk of mine, join us to talk about that legacy. Pamela Swing is a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University outside of Boston. She's also a folklorist, a photographer, a musician who has done extensive research into the fiddle music tradition of the Shetland Islands off of Scotland. She is the granddaughter of Betty Graham Swing and wrote a play, I Want to Go to Jail, about the suffragist and her fellow activists that has been performed several times in the Boston area, including at the Massachusetts State House. Now my second cousin, she comes from the high-achieving end of the family, is at work on a creative nonfiction book about her grandmother. Pam's daughter, Anna Plotkin Swing, is a great-granddaughter of Betty Graham Swing. She is currently a master's student at Smith College School for Social Work in Northampton, Massachusetts. Anna's interests center around addressing intergenerational and complex trauma with a focus on increasing access to mental health care for low-income and racially diverse communities. Previously, she served as the volunteer manager at the Cambridge Women's Center, a community space that serves primarily vulnerable populations, including women experiencing homelessness, domestic violence, social isolation, and mental health concerns. A lifelong feminist, Anna has participated in activism on such causes as racial justice, environmental justice, and reproductive rights. Then we have my niece, Danielle Graham, who lives in San Francisco, is a political activist and humanitarian. She's currently the managing director of Founders Pledge, a nonprofit which maximizes the social impact of a community of entrepreneurs. In 2017, she co-founded Project 100, a political action committee and technology platform which supported the new wave of progressive women running for Congress. She was previously the head of former Prime Minister Tony Blair's foundation in the U.S. and co-founder of the nonprofit Kids for Peace.
I want to start our discussion with Pam Swing, who's done quite extensive research into the life of Betty Graham Swing, one of the, as I mentioned, leading suffragists. What have you found out about Betty Graham Swing? What motivated her to get involved in the suffragist movement?
So she grew up in a family, actually, that advocated for women's rights. She and her sisters would go to suffrage meetings out in Portland, Oregon. But for a long time, she wasn't really ready to commit herself to the movement. It took Alice Paul's National Woman's Party with their activist approach to picketing the White House and trying to really use some more militant action for Betty to finally get involved. And she and her younger sister Alice, 1917, hopped on a train from New York City where Betty was actually in musicals on Broadway. They hopped on a train and went to join a long picket line on November 10th, 1917, and that was the start of her getting into the suffrage movement, and she never looked back.
Wow, and that demonstration in November of 1917, if I recall reading, that led to a series of arrests, including of Betty and Alice, and they were sent to a work camp in Virginia. Is that right?
That's correct. They were sent to the Occoquan Workhouse, where unbeknownst to them, or there was 32 of them that ended up at the workhouse, and the superintendent, Whitaker, was tired of having suffragists sent there, and he hired a bunch of men to beat them up. You can look it up online. It was called the Night of Terror, and it was truly awful. Women were tossed into jail cells and hit their head and became unconscious, and one of them had a heart attack, and Betty and Alice actually escaped being harmed, but they were very much there, and then they all went on an 8-day hunger strike. So it was a very dramatic way for Betty and Alice to join the suffrage movement.
Yeah, that was a sort of a baptism by fire or something. Pretty
exactly.
Incredible. And Betty stayed involved in these efforts longer than Alice did. Alice developed some health problems, I guess, as a result of some of the things that happened.
Yeah, well, she became very anemic during the hunger strike, and I think she decided that this wasn't for her. She instead went into journalism and was an activist in that way. But Betty became a national organizer for Alice Paul's party, National Woman's Party, and she was actually instrumental in getting some of the states to ratify the amendment. And these are the lesser-known stories. She was sent to New Jersey, where there was fierce opposition against the amendment. This is jumping ahead now to 1920, 100 years ago right now. And she managed to get it passed by one vote. Similarly, in West Virginia, she and some other suffragists were there, and they needed one more vote. And the state legislator that agreed to a vote to be that one vote was in California, and they chartered a train for him that came across the country headed towards West Virginia, and people would get up in the middle of the night and wave at the train as it passed their stations, because the newspapers were covering this whole thing that was happening, and they met him at the station and whisked him off to the state house so that they could get the vote passed there too. So there's a lot of stories about what Betty did in the suffrage movement.
Yeah, and it seems as though she's been an inspiration to the three of you, my cousins Pam Swing and Anna Plotkin Swing, as well as my niece Danielle Graham. And Anna Plotkin Swing, you, as we mentioned, are currently studying for your master's degree in the social work school at Smith College in Northampton. Previously had been working at a place called the Women's Center in Cambridge. Tell us about your own activism and work in behalf of women and the degree to which Betty has been an inspiration to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, you know, I think that my work tends to be a little bit more on the individual and internal side of activism. You know, there's so much work to do to change these external systems, but I think that we can't overlook how, you know, we might have internalized oppression ourselves, or how, you know, on our way to systemic change, we still need to be advocating for individuals along the way. And so, you know, working at the Cambridge Women's Center, for instance, and being able to really build community amongst women that don't always have access to safe community outside of spaces like that has been really powerful for my experiences. In terms of how Betty Graham Swing has sort of impacted my path, I think that just sort of growing up with this lore around her, that I always heard stories that my great-grandmother was, you know, worked towards the woman's right to vote, and it really just forms this feeling that I've carried with me that, you know, it is not only my right as a woman to have a voice and to use my voice, but, you know, it's really an an obligation and a calling, but, you know, I am honored to, you know, be following in her footsteps there.
Yeah, that's really great. Danielle Graham, you get an extra slice of thank you pie this morning because getting up early out there on the West Coast to get on the phone with us. The political activist and humanitarian you are a managing director of Founders Pledge. It's a nonprofit that maximizes the social impact of a global community of entrepreneurs. A lot of fundraising among those tech wizards out there in Silicon Valley and so on. In 2017, you were the co-founder of Project 100, a political action committee and technology platform which supported the new wave of progressive women running for Congress. You were previously head of former Prime Minister Tony Blair's foundation in the U.S. and co-founder of the nonprofit Kids for Peace. So you've been doing stuff to try to improve the world since very tender age, back when you were a teenager maybe? Is it been at it that long?
Yeah, I got started pretty young.
And still at it, which is absolutely great. We actually are going to be heading into a bottom of the hour break in a couple of minutes for some CBS news and words from our sponsors. But just before we get there, I wanted to ask you, Danielle, to talk to me about Betty. And you learned some stuff about Betty, I think, in just recent years, right? That kind of opened your eyes to who she was and why she's important.
That's right. You know, in terms of how family history is passed on, my grandfather, your father, Dave, would tell me as a young girl, because I was already interested in politics and was an activist from, you know, a really young age, that I had this history in my family, but there wasn't too much detail added to it. And so at the time when, Donald Trump was elected and there was a lot of kind of heightened activism, particularly amongst women in America, I really went back to that history and wanted to discover more about Betty and Alice and the struggle that they had fought for women's rights and equality. And it actually led me to Pam, who's also on this call, who I had never met before, hadn't encountered as a second cousin, but had come across the history she was writing about the suffragist movement. And so it really is a testament, I think, to how important it is to capture and tell those stories. From how that helped to inspire me and my colleagues and friends who helped launch this political organization as well.
Wow. We can talk more about it after the break. We do need to go hear some CBS news for a couple of minutes and then back shortly with Anna Plotkin-Swing, Pam Swing, Danielle Graham, my three guests on the Dave Graham Show here on this Monday morning. We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Welcome back, and we are talking with three women who are related to me and who are also descendants of Betty Graham Swing, one of the leading national suffragists who, with her sister Alice Graham, Alice and Betty were two of the suffragists involved in the push to get women the right to vote, which culminated in enactment of the 19th Amendment in August of 1920, 100 years ago this month. I think I saw in the New York Times that the official effective date, I guess, of the amendment was August the 26th. And speaking of the Times had a very nice write-up on this a couple of weeks ago in which they interviewed two of my guests, Pam Swing and Anna Plotkin Swing, and they're talking about their ancestor, Betty Graham. Of course, Betty Graham, Pam Swing's grandmother, and Anna Plotkin Swing's great-grandmother. And all of them, all of us, I should say, being descendants of a couple who came over from Denmark, I think, and settled in Omaha late in the 19th century, and So you can credit them or blame them for all of us. Andreas and Karen Graham came from Denmark. There's a little town in Denmark called Gram, where I think it was in those environs where those folks came from. Anyway, so here we all are today, and we were talking just with my niece Danielle Graham before the break about the about her work and its inspiration from Betty and Allison. And Danielle, tell us about Project 100. This was a fascinating effort you got involved in a couple of years ago to get progressive women elected to Congress, met with a lot of success.
Yes. So I started Project 100 with some co-founders from the Obama administration, from the U.S. Digital Service in particular. And, you know, kind of going back to that initial motivation for us, one of the things that I learned from Pam as I was discovering this history with her was that a big motivation for the militant suffragists was that the approach that others were taking to suffrage was this kind of slow and steady approach where you might gain women's suffrage state by state, but it could take a very long time to do. And at the same time, as I was looking towards how could we get more women representation in Congress, talking to kind of establishment organizations a couple of years ago, I was basically told, along with my co-founders, that we similarly need to take a slow and steady approach, that every year women had been gaining, you know, a few seats here and a few seats there, and eventually we may have equal representation. But here we were, nearly 100 years after women gained the right to vote, and women only were 1 in 5 members of Congress in 2017. So we founded Project 100 because we are impatient, we are young, we are, you know, knocking at the doors, just as the suffragists did, and wanting to see change a lot faster. And so we use technology to build a platform to help Americans who are looking for progressive women to support, to find and connect with the new wave of women who are running all around the country. And we deployed some kind of new tech tools to do this as well, to help people find candidates running based on interest and background, as well as geolocation, and develop a kind of a trending algorithm that helps people first see the women who were really pulling ahead, where their money and their time and their efforts really might go the furthest in helping elect more women.
Wow, it sounds like a very sophisticated effort, and ended up kind of folding up its tent, though, as you got done with the 2018 congressional cycle. And fair to say what sort of subsumed into Emily's List, a better known group out there working to elect progressive women, too?
That's right. So we were founded with a specific political target. The name Project 100 was to achieve 100 progressive women in Congress by the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote this year in 2020. Mm-hmm. And when we had set that target, and again, had kind of talked to establishment Democratic organizations, we were told at the time that that was kind of a crazy goal to hold, a 22-seat gain over 2 election cycles. Had never been done before. And so, you know, everyone had thought that it wasn't going to be possible, and in fact, that target was not only achieved but surpassed in only 1 election cycle of us existing. So at that point, you know, what was amazing, it certainly wasn't just Project 100, although we were able to raise a large amount of money and awareness to women candidates. Americans really made this happen. But, you know, then as we hit that first benchmark and achieved 106 progressive women in the last election cycle, we then had to look ahead to, you know, what's going to continue progress. And we did not see that in this current election cycle, kind of looking ahead, we didn't think there'd be the same wave either of women running or, you know, women to support. And so we wanted to go the, you know, a kind of more steady route of supporting an organization subsuming into Emily's List that already was doing great work to support progressive.
Now, Pam Swing, among your recent projects, has been a play which has gotten favorable reviews as it's been performed several times in the Boston area, and it is about the suffragists, right?
That's correct. It's about the last time that suffragists were arrested for picketing President Wilson, and it was an incident that took place outside the Massachusetts State House in Boston in February of 1919. Betty Graham was there, and they were arrested. They were sent to the Charles Street Jail. Their goal at the time was to create publicity about the fact that the United States House of Representatives had passed the 19th Amendment at that point, but it kept failing in the Senate by one or two votes, and they needed, at that point, just one vote to pass the amendment, and then it could go out to the states for ratification. And in the play, I follow the ups and downs of whether or not it's been a success for them to go ahead and get arrested yet again and end up in jail, and is that going to help this goal of succeeding? And you have to watch the play to find out.
And the play is called I Want to Go to Jail. That's a quote. Who said that?
It's not actually a quote. Interestingly enough, it was the name of an article on this incident by James Keenally, who is an academic. And I used that article a lot in my research, and I eventually tracked him down. He was very elderly at the point that I finally met him. He was in a nursing home in the Boston area. And I asked him, so who said that? Who said I want to go to jail? And he said, oh, I just made that up. but at that point, okay. I'd already written the play and I've used that phrase, and he gave me permission to use that phrase. So that's the honest origin of it.
Okay.
I have a website, iwanttogotojail.com. All the words run together if people want to look it up.
Yeah, that's great. It must be quite a tough time. And nobody's doing much in the performing arts with the COVID-19 crisis going on. So I expect that's had a big impact on the rollout of this play, right?
Yes, we're switching to Zoom. We're going to do. There's three performances this fall, and they'll all be on Zoom. That's just the way it is. And people all over the country actually have expressed interest since I made the website, and they're coming up with their own solutions, doing play readings also by Zoom and stuff like that. Yeah.
It's a 40-minute, one-act play, correct?
Correct.
And it was performed last year, of course, before the pandemic hit.
Yeah, it was performed a number of times, actually, yeah.
And I saw a picture actually, I think, of one performance underway at the State House in Boston. Quite a setting for this play about events happening there.
Yes, that was very exciting. That was on the centennial of the event itself, and we actually performed it on these beautiful marble steps of the grand staircase inside the State House.
Yeah, it's of course a striking building and. A great setting for an historic event, which happened there, and it is being depicted in this play. So that is really something. Anna, have you seen your mom's play?
I have. It's a lot of fun. I'm very proud of her for this work that she's created.
Mm-hmm. And this is something which it seems like it could end up possibly in, I don't know, maybe a PBS production or something like that. Any possibilities like that opening up?
They haven't yet, but I think that's a great idea.
Okay, we just launched it here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
It all started here.
It all, yeah, there we go. Danielle, I'm wondering your current work with Founders Pledge. Tell us about that in a little more detail. What is Founders Pledge? What is the strategy that it is trying to use?
So we work with primarily founders and investors to align them with high impact opportunities to do good in the world. The reason that I am working on this project now is having been a humanitarian, working both as a field humanitarian, kind of doing frontline work in Africa and the Middle East, and worked as foundations for the majority of my life at this point, I have been frustrated by, again, kind of at times, the slower pace of change than I would like to see, and particularly when people have really good intentions to do good, but that those intentions don't often result in their intended outcome. So Founders Pledge exists to help people who have emerging resources find and fund the opportunities that they really can do the most good. We're largely a research institute, so we're a community of people who take a pledge, and then our organization has a large number of researchers who are finding some of the highest impact opportunities that people can fund globally. Our recommendations are available to the public, so you can go to founderspledge.com and click on our research section to see where you might invest your money for things like climate change or women's empowerment or global poverty alleviation.
Wow. And you have folks who are stepping up, who are people have significant means, and they are chipping in for these various causes that you all are suggesting, I gather, making a big impact that way. So that's something else.
That's right. We've had about 1,500 people pledge so far, nearly $3 billion. And, you know, similar again to kind of what we're talking about today, this is largely a group of emergent philanthropists, so, you know, young people who want to do things differently. And it's really inspiring to see the change they've already been able to do together.
Yeah, and I actually was looking at the website of Founders Pledge last evening, and I noticed that there is definitely a youth movement in the staff there. A lot of people look pretty young in those staff biopics and so on. Very like yourself. I also one of the things that has struck me that as I've kind of studied up a little bit recently on women's suffrage and passage of the 19th Amendment and all of that. So for the first 150 years of this country's history, women did not have the right to vote. And I frankly, that kind of makes me slap my forehead and go, what? Why? The world was a very different place back then. But Pam, you're kind of the historian. You are the historian in the group here, I guess. And so maybe you could tell us, why do you think it took until 1920 to realize that, hey, there's a other half of the population here? What's going on?
Well, there was a lot of misogyny. Women were basically considered second-class citizens. And I don't know how to answer the why of that because it feels so wrong to me. But that's, you know, that was the legacy that the settlers coming over brought with them. When women married, their property became their husband's property. Their children became their husband's property. I mean, it's the way the system was, and it was really hard for women when they started asking for the right to vote and a bunch of other women's rights issues as well. Change happened very creakily. As Danielle says, change, it's really frustrating to watch how slowly change happens sometimes. Another related issue to all of this is that when the vote was finally passed in 1920, it did not work for black women to have the right to vote, or Native Americans or Asian Americans. They were all still excluded in various ways, state by state, from having the right to vote. And it took till the Voting Rights Act of 1965 for black women and men to really be able to vote in large numbers. So that's an even more head-shaking, cannot-believe-it fact.
Yeah, I guess, I think it also shows that that this evolution continues, and it's taken an awful long time, but it continues, and you know, we have more work to do even in 2020 as we continue to push for racial equality and equality of the sexes, etc. I mean, I was going to ask about 2020, but let me go to 1920 first, Pam, and ask you. You said there was the right to vote, and then there were some other issues that these folks were also working on. What were some of those?
The issues I was raising, the fact that a married woman lost the rights to her property once she gets married and rights to her children. So they were trying to change that kind of situation as well.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, there's more. I can't think of them all right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, how do you think we've done in the last 100 years in achieving some of those goals? I mean, obviously the right to vote is a big goal that was achieved in 1920. These other things were probably still pending, or many of them were. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like we're making progress, et cetera?
I do. I think the situation has changed dramatically. My mom, when she got married, was not allowed to have a checking account in her own name. And, you know, that's simply is no longer the case. I mean, there's lots of ways in which the situation has changed. It's not enough yet. Women still don't earn as much as men do. You know, the Equal Rights Amendment still has not passed, although I would like to make a quick aside here and say that Betty Graham in later years worked very hard for the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1930s and 1940s. But that still has not passed. And there's still lots of ways, Danielle, I'm sure, could speak to this as well, and that women are not equal to men in our country.
Yeah. Let me bring Anna back into the conversation here and ask you, Anna, some of the ways in which women are not equal or still in America and in the world do manifest themselves in your work, I'm sure, just with the individuals who come into a women's center or a counseling session and have their own issues they're wrestling with and so on. How big an impact do these social issues have in sort of the individual person's ability to kind of cope and get through life?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge, definitely. And I think that, something to sort of keep in mind is how these systems of oppression interact with each other. You know, absolutely, feminism is an important issue, but it can't be sort of looked at, disentangled from racist systems of oppression, from poverty, from access to health care, all those issues. How patriarchal systems affect me as a white woman are going to be very different from how they affect women of color and so on. For instance, the U.S. has one of the worst maternal death rates within developed countries. And, you know, that number as a whole is horrible. But then you zoom in a little bit and you see that even within that, Black women are, still three times as likely to die during childbirth as white women are. And so, you know, really making sure that, you know, yes, we're, you know, talking about feminism and about women's issues, and then making sure that we're seeing the bigger picture in that as well.
Pam Swing, back in the suffrage movement, there was, I think, a strategic decision made, if the reading I've done indicates correctly, that we basically, the decision was, should we try to go for universal suffrage right now and bring in black women, black men, Asian, Native Americans, and so on? And you mentioned this a few minutes ago, but I wanted to really pursue it just in the few minutes we have left and ask, what about Betty and Alice? Were they siding with those who wanted to push for universal suffrage, or there was a strategic decision, I understand, that maybe we needed to essentially leave people of color by the side of the road to bring in some of the more racist elements in the U.S. Senate or the U.S. Congress to support just giving women the right to vote? How did that break down, and where did our ancestors land on that?
So I don't have any written account that I've found in which either Betty or Alice explicitly talk about that. But the fact that Betty was working with Alice Paul kind of implicitly says that she was willing to go along with Alice Paul's strategy. And Alice Paul's strategy was that she would lose the southern states if she included especially African-American women in the suffrage movement. And since they needed 36 states to ratify the amendment, she just didn't think she could get the amendment through without making that political compromise. I think it's unfortunate, but it's you know, it's history as it was. That's the decision that they made. There were a number of black suffragists who are finally now starting to be acknowledged. And in my play, which, by the way, I co-wrote with a Brandeis student who's from Ghana, so she had a very interesting perspective on all of this. And we made sure to work in a reference to a local African-American suffragist in the Boston area, and we also tried to have a racially diverse cast, sort of a la Hamilton, as a way of saying we acknowledge that blacks are left out, we can't fix the past, but we can be clear-eyed about it.
Yeah, that's certainly something which, again, I think speaks to the degree to which the world really was different back then, and I think we can be thankful for the progress we've made since then, although certainly still plenty of work to do, and that is the...
Black Lives Matter is uncovering just the awful extent to which we still have work to do.
For sure. And Danielle Graham, I'm wondering your thoughts on what are the main issues that are kind of the top two or three things we need to get to as we continue to work toward equality in the United States?
Well, you know, I think the main thing is just getting to a place where we do have equal representation. And, you know, I remember early in the days, Dave, when I was starting Project 100, we had some conversations about the whys. So what kind of legislation would change, or would we have better governance? And I think, you know, the research that's been done on what changes when you do have greater equality is important. But even more important is just, you know, women shouldn't have to govern better or govern differently to be able to have an equal seat at the table. And so what we're seeing now that we do have more women elected, even since the last election cycle, is that we have tremendous leaders who are now having a voice in Congress who weren't there before. So when you think about, you know, how did Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, these women who are now just part of our government and actually legislating change as leaders in our country, how did they get their seat at the table? They did it through a similar kind of level of personal sacrifice and dedication that, you know, the suffragists took of really great individual sacrifice that it takes to run for office. And so as we, you know, think again to what inspiration can be drawn from the suffragists or women today, most often when I'm talking to young women who are considering running for office, they'll say, well, you know, I don't really see putting my family through that, or it's really hard, or I don't want to be in kind of the nastiness of politics. And there's a certain aspect of really just being willing to be uncomfortable for a greater cause. And it's something that, again, I was really inspired by in learning about the suffragist history and willing to make some kind of personal sacrifices myself in pursuing this greater aim. And I think as we get more women represented in Congress, we will see the follow-on changes to, you know, policy issues that aren't only related to women, but will help lift all of society up.
Danielle Graham, my niece and Managing Director of Founders Pledge, Anna Plotkin Swing and Pam Swing have been my guests this last 45 minutes. It's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you three joining me on the Dave Graham Show. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. It was a great time.
And we will call it a day on this edition of the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our program. And don't forget, keep wearing those masks and maintaining that social distance. Stay healthy, everybody. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.